So if courage is not doing flips off the high board or off a mountain, if it's not leaping tall buildings in a single bound, then what is it? I think we often think of the big stuff when we think of courage. We think of running into a burning building and saving a small child. We may think of coverings in a movie theater, covering our friend or our spouse's or our child's body so that they are not hit by the bullet. We think of rescuing our fellow soldier in a firefight, or maybe just holding their hand while they take their last breaths. We may think of someone who has survived and endured the loss of a child. Those are very big things, and they take big courage, but sometimes all of us don't experience those things. So if we're going to be present to courage in our daily lives, we have to think about courage in the small things, the courage in the muck, in the frustration, in the exhaustion, in the piles of laundry, and in the dark corners of our soul that happen as we walk daily. But before we can even think of those matters, we have to come to terms with something, and that is, before there is courage, or always when there is courage, first there is fear. Because courage is acting in the face of fear. Maybe not getting rid of it, but acting anyway. Eddie Rickenbacker was a World War I flying ace, and he got the Medal of Honor, and he said that courage is doing what you are afraid to do, and there could be no courage unless you're scared. So if you've been scared, you're in good company. My guess is that we all have been. Some of you are familiar with the Enneagram, and each one of the personality types on the Enneagram, there's 9, they have a special fear that corresponds with them. So I'm assuming you all have personalities. So I would assume also that you all have fears. It might be the fear of being evil or corrupt. It could be the fear of being unloved or unwanted. It could be the fear of being unworthy or unlikable. The fear of failure. You know, those last ones are my fear. I grew up, for better or for worse, as an overachiever. You know, I was the one that always got in there and worked so hard. You know, I did all the homework a week ahead. I got an A on every test. Those are the ones that raised their hands in the front row and wanted to participate in every single discussion. Many of you hated those people, right? But that's who I was, and so a lot of people might not imagine that I was afraid, but inside I was. I was afraid that I'd be found out, that I was unworthy. I would be found, and I wouldn't be liked, that I wasn't very likable, and that ultimately I would fail. So you have to learn ways to cope with failure. And when I was younger, and maybe even sometimes now, my way of coping was, don't fail. Don't do anything that you don't know you will be successful at doing. You know, if you're not going to be right up in the running, or maybe even number one, then just stop doing it. Just don't avoid it completely. So I started off my life doing this. One of the first examples was, as I mentioned, I was a diver, and I was really great until I was about age 7, and I could do a flip, and I learned how to do the approach and jump appropriately at the end of the board and all that. And then I was going to be in a diving contest, and I'd won all the blue ribbons up to that point. And then I was going to be in a diving contest where my competition could do a 1.5. I did it once, and I decided, nope, never going to do that again. Stopped diving, never was in another contest, that was the end of that. It was 8th grade when I took my last art class. I spent days working on a stuffed rabbit pinata on one ski. I got a B on it. I said, I'm done with art. If I can't get an A, I'm not taking another art class. I'm not doing any more art. I managed to get out of PE in high school. They play basketball in PE. As you might guess, that wasn't my best sport. They have to play dodgeball. I hated being hit by that ball, and it was always me. They always picked on me. I was the little one. I couldn't go as fast. I was the flat-chested one. I didn't want to be in the showers with all those other girls. So I got out of PE by becoming a pom-pom girl. And then they thought that was enough exercise. They let me go. But as I got older, I decided that this wasn't the best way of coping, to always avoid the things that you can't do well. And so I began to do what we read about this morning. I decided that I was going to try some things just for the sake of trying them. just for the enjoyment of them. Even if I fail, maybe I might learn something from it. Maybe I might get better. And so I started doing some art. I have a slide up there that shows you one of my pieces of art. If we could get that on the overhead, my lovely artish kind of thing. Or maybe not. There it is. Okay, so I couldn't paint, I couldn't draw, I couldn't do ceramics, I wasn't too good at piñatas. But I was in a cafe one day, and there was this, people had cut out all this paper and, you know, put them in different shapes, and I thought, I can do that, so I did. I made about 15 of those one year, gave them to everybody for Christmas. I don't even see them hanging in anybody's house except for my own. But it was art-ish, and I enjoyed it, and it was fun, and I was proud of it, so that was good enough. There's another slide up there. Next, I decided I would take on sewing. Now, when I was in 7th and 8th grade, I pulled out every stitch that I put in. And so I gave up sewing pretty early on. But when I had children and then when I had grandchildren, I decided I had to reintroduce myself to sewing. And so last year, I made that dress for my granddaughter. And it's dress-ish, wouldn't you say? It's dress-ish. It passed. It puckered a little in front. The straps weren't quite even. But she was happy, so I was happy. And also what I've taken on is I've taken on pickleball. Now, in college, I got a B in tennis only because I got 100% on the test of the rules. Otherwise, I was the third worst in the class. And so I gave that up, but I finally decided I wanted to do something sports-like. So I took on pickleball, and I play every week with a whole bunch of people from the church. It's really fun. If I play with my husband, he can beat me 11-0 every time. Occasionally, the most I've ever gotten was 7 points, but I'm really enjoying it, and I'm actually getting better. So I'm trying to learn to live ishly. So, you know, those are some simple ways that we might deal with our failures. But you know, even when it comes to the really tough stuff, when it comes to the areas where we have some serious fears, we have to deal with the same kind of thing. We can feel incredible shame, and therewith we don't try things. But we can also live ishly in those areas as well. I did a little research as I was preparing for this sermon, and I went around and talked to some people, and I said, so what's the most courageous thing that you can remember ever doing in your life? A few people came up with something just like that. A good friend of mine said, yeah, that's easy. It was facing breast cancer. I would usually put that in the category of a big thing. But then there's the daily walking with it. There's the getting up out of bed when you're exhausted in the morning. There's the losing your hair. There's the losing control. There's the need to ask for help. There's the daily presence to courage that you have to have when you face a disease like breast cancer. Another friend of mine said, well, it was when I decided to leave the church of my childhood. That is very difficult because you're leaving behind maybe long-held beliefs. You're leaving behind traditions that you've really come to enjoy and that you appreciate and they're meaningful to you. You're leaving behind perhaps a good set of rules that were easier to live by. They were very set and, you know, very simple, and you could go with that. You're leaving behind family members or friends. But you know, you really don't. You take those things with you, and they continue to enrich your life. They continue to inform your life, and they prepare you for the next step. But it's tough. It takes courage. And then I realized that for many of the people that I talked to, but especially including myself, that being courageous in daily life does mean letting go. We mentioned the letting go of control. It might be the letting go of a relationship. When I was in Guatemala with Stephen just a couple weeks ago, he was having a conversation with three young women, each of whom were in different stages of relationships. And so he started talking to them about what it means, what kind of a relationship you should have if you're really deciding to marry a person. And he said, you know, if that person can make you the best person that you could possibly be, then that's the person you may want to marry. But you also need to make them the best person they could possibly be. If not, it may be a relationship that you need to let go of. And that's very difficult to do. It takes a lot of courage. But in fact, it may be the very best thing. You need to let go of the fear of disappointing others. You may need to let go of the fear of causing another's pain. But especially, at least for me, it's letting go of the voices in your head. And a lot of these voices come from your childhood, from your mother or your father or your teacher or your coach or whoever it might have been. The voices in your head that said, you are inadequate. You are wrong. You don't just do wrong things, you are wrong. They might say, you're just not good enough. You're never going to be good enough at that. But the funny thing about those voices is that they just don't belong to other people. They become part of our own voice, and so we tell ourselves those things over and over again. So when we want to live courageously, we have to overcome that incredible sense, perhaps, of shame or fear, face it, but act anyway. One of the favorite ways of shaming, we come by naturally, as I mentioned, our families. And in our family, one of the chief tools of shaming was sarcasm. Now, for a long time, I thought sarcasm was fun. You know, it's funny, you kind of look intelligent and sophisticated, and if somebody says, oh, you know, that really hurt, you can say, oh, I was just kidding. And a few years ago, I was talking with a good friend of mine that's in my book group, and she said, you know, behind sarcasm is ridicule and belittling. It's usually anger and frustration and resentment, and it's not funny at all. It's just a way of shaming in a new way. And so that's the kind of, that's how I developed a lot of sense of inadequacy and fear. So I asked myself, what are the main ways that I have acted courageously in my life? What causes me to use the most courage in my daily living? When do I need to be present to courage, or when have I been? And the very first thing that came to my mind is when I have to ask for forgiveness. When I have to tell myself the truth, and then I have to share that truth with someone else. Usually it's my spouse, it's Jose, it's one of my children, it's a friend, and to tell them the truth, to reveal that I've maybe told a lie, or I've betrayed them in some way, or I haven't lived up to my own standards that I set for being a good parent, for being a good spouse, for being a good friend. It's really, really difficult, it's really painful, and it's what I have to overcome, and it's how, and I have acted courageously, just occasionally, often not, but occasionally. I just celebrated my 60th birthday, and all four of my four children came to visit, and they were sitting around one night, and as a gift for my birthday, some of them decided they would tell me how I had failed as a parent. It was actually really, really awful. But for the first, maybe not the first time, but I realized I had to listen to what they had to say, even if I didn't agree, even if my inclination in my shame was to defend myself and to justify and to say, well, really, it wasn't that bad, or you just didn't understand. I had to sit and I had to listen, and it was difficult. But in the end, it opened up a whole new relationship with my children, and a whole new freedom, and a whole new truthfulness that probably wouldn't have happened or may not have happened any other way. So it was a gift. So why should we allow ourselves to cross into that intersection between fear and courage? Because it's a very vulnerable place. You remember that dream, I'm sure you still have it at times, where you show up at class, you have no clothes on? That's what it feels like, it's nakedness. When you step out in front of people and you act courageously, sometimes usually you're going to feel very, very vulnerable. But the advantage of that is there are some benefits. First of all, when you speak the truth and when you enter into that vulnerability, you get to discover and you get to appreciate and you get to grow in your authentic self, who you are really called and created to be by God. And there's a freedom in that. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Sometimes it feels like it's going to be the end of a relationship or an end of a marriage or whatever it might be, but in fact, there is a freedom in telling the truth and being your authentic self. Sometimes you're going to experience growth, you're going to experience healing. You may even experience compassion and understanding in a way that you've never been able to experience before. So there is a plus to doing it. But how on earth do we get the courage to do it? I mean, the Bible says, be not afraid. Well, it's a nice thing to command, but how do you just, boom, okay, I won't be afraid. You know, be courageous, have courage. How do we do that? And as I sat with that and I thought about it, I realized that I am 100% sure that God loves me. I'm 100% sure that, in fact, I am worthy. God created me. And when God did his whole creation thing, he said, it is good. And that includes me. And I also believe that God is with me in whatever circumstances and wherever I go and whatever I do. I have one last story I want to share with you. Don't fall asleep yet. It has to do with my father. In 1980, my dad was 64 years old and then 65, and he had lymphoma. And on top of that, his house burned to the ground, our house, my childhood home. And on top of that, my mother fell down some stairs and broke her hip. So it was a really bad year. And I went through, in the last few months of what turned out to be the last few months of his life, I went to stay with him. I had two children already. I was married. I took my two children. I went and stayed with him for 3 months. And my faith was young, and it was innocent, and maybe it was naive, but I really, really, really wanted him to live. I was only 24 years old. I didn't want to lose my dad. And so one night, I was out in a cabin that was behind their house, and I was praying. And oh, and someone had come to me. That on top of that, there's this one other little factor. Some person that I didn't know so well in the community came to me and said, I really believe your dad is supposed to be healed of his cancer. And she said, I have other relatives and other friends that have cancer, and I haven't had this feeling, but I really feel like God has been telling me that he's going to heal your dad. And I really wanted to believe that, and I really wanted that to happen, so I'm going with that, okay? So this night out in this cabin, I was praying, and I thought, well, I'll try to imagine God healing my father. And this is one of those moments that Stephen talked about that you don't really share with maybe no one at all or very many people because it's so weird, but here it is, I'm sharing with all of you. And so I imagined my dad riding his horse with his jean jacket up the mountain and me watching him from behind as I had many, many times. And then I imagined a bright light surrounding my dad, and I imagined the hands of Jesus on him. And I just thought, you know, Jesus, put your hands on my dad and heal my father. And then I fell asleep. The next morning, I walked over to the cabin, hugging, you know, carrying two children, and wandered in, and my dad goes, I need to talk to you. I need to talk to you and your mom right now. I'm like, okay, well, we'll talk. We sat down, and he said, you're not going to believe what happened last night. And I'm like, wow, what? You know, what happened? He goes, well, I was sitting in my bed at about 10 o'clock at night. It was that time you're sort of between dream and awake, and all of a sudden, the entire room was bright. It was just this bright light. And I'm just like freaking out inside. And I'm going, really? And I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything about what I'd been praying. Because yeah, there was this bright, bright light. And I wasn't sure if I was awake or asleep, but I looked over and your mother was a long ways away. She was on the other side of the bed. They had a king size bed at that time. She was way over on the other side of the bed. And I kind of touched myself to make sure I was really awake, and I really was. And he goes, and then I felt these hands on me. And at this point, I was about to completely lose it. I couldn't believe it. He goes, I felt these hands on me. And I immediately thought, oh, I'm healed. And he says, I started feeling all over, but I still had all my tumors, because he had large tumors all over his body by then. I could still feel my tumors. And he goes, I that kind of surprised me, because I thought maybe I was healed, but I still felt my tumors. He goes, but you know what? I realized in that moment that no matter what happens, and no matter where I go, and even if I walk through that valley of the shadow of death, which my mom and my dad said together, the Psalm 23, every single night together for their entire marriage, even if I walk through that valley as I am walking, and even if I walk into death, not just the shadow, I know God is with me. Of course, I went ahead and told him what I had prayed and how miraculous it was. But a few weeks later, my dad died. And at first, it was like, it just can't be. You know, he can't. He was going to be healed. And then one day I realized he was. He was healed. He was healed way better than any kind of physical healing. He had the assurance that God was with him, with Gordon Street, and he was going to be with him no matter what and no matter where. And so having had that experience, I can say to you that I believe that God is with us and will be with us and can. Therefore, we can be present to courage, and we can have courage. I want to share with you the full text of, well, not the full, part of the text from Romans 8. What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness, or danger, or the sword? No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor demons, neither the present, nor the future, nor any powers, nor height, or depth or anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. So as you face whatever you're facing today and each day, be present to courage. Ask yourself, how would God have me be courageous despite my fears, in the face of my fears, in this moment?